safety in Vietnam. He returned to the States and got his Ph.D. in world history from Temple University, after which he was stationed in Germany, then in Japan. He commanded a mechanized brigade in the Persian Gulf and spent time in Saudi Arabia before returning to the U.S. to try for a job at the Department of State. Instead, the president offered him the post of deputy director at Op Center. He wasn't sorry he took the job. It was exhilarating to be involved in crises around the world. He still savored the aftertaste of his recent successful incursion into North Korea. But he didn't like being anyone's sidekick, let alone Paul Hood's. The computer beeped. Rogers walked toward the desk. He punched Control A to receive. Bob Herbert's round face filled the screen, transmitted by a fiber-optic camera on top of the monitor. The 38-year-old National Intelligence Officer looked tired.
"Good morning, Mac."
"Hi, Bob," Rogers said. "What are you doing here on a Sunday?"
"Been here since last night. Stephen Veens at NRO called me at home when I came in. Didn't you read my memo?"
"Not yet," Mike said. "What's up?"
"Why don't you check the email box and beat me back?" Herbert said. "The memo has all the times and exact spellings, and the satellite recon."
"Why don't you just brief me?" Mike said, dragging a hand across his face. Email, beeps, fiber-optic conferencing. How the hell did spy work go from Nathan Hale unbowed to Matt Still's screensavers of Derek Flint dancing Swan Lake? Intelligence work should be physically exhausting, like lovemaking, not electronic voyeurism.
"Sure, Mike. I'll give you a rundown," Herbert replied, somewhat concerned. "Are you okay?"
"Yeah," Rogers said. "Just a little out of sync with the late 20th century."
"Whatever you say," Herbert responded.
Rogers didn't bother to explain. The intelligence officer was a good man, someone who had paid the price for what he did. He lost his wife and the use of his legs in the Beirut embassy bombing in 1983. But after a great deal of initial reluctance, even Herbert was beginning to be seduced by the computers, satellites, and fiber-optic cables. He called this technological triad a God's-eye view of the world.
"What we've got," Herbert said, "are two things. Maybe related, maybe not. You know we've been picking up microwave radiation from the Neva as it passes near the Hermitage in St. Petersburg."
"Yes," Rogers responded.
"At first we figured the radiation was from the TV studio the Russians are building at the Hermitage to broadcast artwork to schools. But my TV specialist has been watching their test broadcasts, and they're all in 153 to 11,950 kilohertz range. That's not what we're getting from the Neva."
"So the TV studio's a front for some other kind of operation," Rogers said.
"Most likely. We thought it might be a new security setup to handle the extra tourists the Russians are expecting for the city's 300th anniversary. But that doesn't compute."
"How so?"
"Martha Mackall called a friend at Treasury to get me the budgets for the Russian Ministries of Culture and Education," Herbert said. "There isn't a ruble in either of them for what should be a $5 to $7 million facility. So we hacked around and found funds for the studio in the budget of the Ministry of the Interior."
"That doesn't mean anything," Rogers said. "Our government transfers money all the time."
"Yes," said Herbert, "but the ministry earmarked $20 million for the project. Interior is run by Dugin, the hardline minister who just lost the election over there," Rogers said. "Some of that money may have gone to his presidential campaign."
"That's a possibility," Herbert agreed. "But there's something else which indicates that the TV studio may be more than that. At 1:30 yesterday afternoon, we intercepted a communication from the northern sector of St. Petersburg to New York. An order for bagels."
"Come again," Rogers said.
"It was a brunch order faxed from St. Petersburg to the Bastonia Bagel Shop in Brighton Beach. They asked for an onion bagel with cream cheese, a salt bagel with butter, an everything bagel plain, and two garlic bagels with lox."
"A takeout order, from half a world away," Rogers said. "And it wasn't a joke."
"No," said Herbert. "Bostonia sent back a confirmation. Definitely spooks."
"Right," Rogers agreed. "Any idea what it means?"
"We sent it over to cryptology," Herbert continued, "and they're stumped. Lynn Dominick says the different bagels could represent sectors of the city, or of the world. Or they could be agents.
The different kinds of spreads could stand for different targets. She said she'll keep working on it, but she called Bostonia, and they've got a dozen kind of bagels with 20 different schmears. It'll take a while. What about that shop, the Bostonia? Rogers asked. Clean until now. Owned by the Belniks, a family that came from Kiev, via Montreal in 1961. So they're a deep plant, said Rogers.
Very, Herbert agreed.
Darrell informed the FBI, and they put a stakeout team on the shop. Nothing's happened so far except for bagel deliveries.
Darrell McCaskey was OpCenter's FBI and Interpol liaison. By coordinating efforts between the agencies, he allowed each to benefit from the other's resources.
Rogers asked, "You're sure they're bagels?" "We videotaped the open bags from a rooftop. Examine the footage," Herbert said. "They look like bagels, all right. And the deliveryman seems to get the right amount of money for the size of each order. Nobody that gets a delivery goes out for lunch, so they must be eating what's in the bags."
Rogers nodded.
"So that brings us back to something brewing in St. Petersburg. What's DI-6 doing about it?"
"They've got a man on site," said Herbert. "Commander Hubbard has promised to keep us informed."
"Good," Rogers said. "And what do you think about all this?"
"I feel like I just took a short Twilight Zone hop back into the 1960s, Herbert said. "When the Russians spend big money on something these days, I worry."
Rogers nodded as the intelligence chief signed off.
Herbert was right. Russians weren't gracious losers, and they were faced with the possibility of the loser in an election having access to a secret operation with agents in the U.S.
Rogers was worried, too. Chapter 8, Sunday, 4:35 p.m., St. Petersburg. Whatever the season, the heat of the day leaves St. Petersburg almost immediately, chased away by the wind that rises from the Gulf in the late afternoon. The cool air is carried to every corner of the city by the webwork of rivers and canals, which is why the warm glow of indoor lights appears earlier in the day. It's also the reason why pedestrians, who brave the often brutal winds and knifing cold, feel a special kinship after sundown. The effect of sundown was almost supernatural, thought Fields Hutton. For nearly 2 hours he had been sitting beneath a tree on the banks of the Neva, reading manuscripts stored in his Toshiba laptop. At the same time he was listening to his Walkman, that was actually a radio receiver, tuned to the frequency of the peso behind the door. Now, as he watched the sun drop lower in the sky and the streets begin to empty and the riverside promenade become virtually deserted, he felt as though people had to be indoors before the vampires and ghosts came out to prey. "Either that," he reflected, "or I've been editing horror and science fiction comic books for far too long." He was getting cold. He felt colder than even his London-hardened flesh was accustomed to. What was worse, he was beginning to think that the afternoon had been wasted. All he had heard since he tuned into the bug was trivial chatter about sports, women, whip-cracking bosses, crowbars ripping up crates, and the comings and goings of people working on the TV facility. Not exactly the kind of surveillance that made the pulses race back at DI-6. He looked out across the river, then gazed back toward the Hermitage. The museum was striking, its dozens of white columns, now ruddy with sunset, and the ribbed dome gleaming. The tour buses were beginning to carry their groups away. The day shift started to leave. The night shift was just arriving. The local citizens who had spent their Sunday at the museum were filing out to meet trolley buses or to take the 15-minute walk to the nearest metro stop, the Nevsky Prospekt station. Soon, like the streets themselves, even the great museum would be deserted. Fields Hutton hoped that Leon had been able to get him a hotel room. He was going to have to come back in the morning and continue his surveillance. He was convinced that if anything untoward was going on here, the TV studio was the place. The Englishman decided to go back inside and stake out the room for a few minutes, to watch and see if someone other than the work crew used the room near closing time. Someone he might be able to describe to the photo division at DI-6, a military person in civvies, a government official, a foreign agent. What's more, there was always confusion and pressure in the days before and immediately after the start of any new operation. Moreover, a worker leaving the place might say or do something that would tell him what was really happening here. Closing up his computer and rising on bones that an American agent once described as belonging to Arthur Fiedler, he stood with a symphony of pops,
Fields Hutton brushed off his pants and left the Walkman on as he walked briskly toward the museum. To the right he saw a couple that had just left the museum strolling hand in hand along the river.
He thought of Peggy,
not of the first fateful walk they took, the one where she brought him into the spy business, but of the walk just 5 days before along the banks of the Thames.
They had talked about marriage for the first time, and Peggy admitted that she was leaning toward it.
Of course, Peggy had the constitution of the Leaning Tower of Pisa, and it might take her an eternity to fall, but he was willing to run the risk. She wasn't quite the demure creature he had always envisioned himself ending up with, but he enjoyed her pluck. She had the face of an angel, and most important, she was well worth waiting for. He smiled as a young woman jogged toward the river with her Jack Russell Terrier. He didn't think they had the English breed in Russia, though the black market was smuggling anything and everything these days, including dogs that were fashionable in the West. The woman was dressed in sweat clothes and a baseball cap and carried a small plastic water bottle. As she approached, he noticed she wasn't perspiring. That seemed strange, since the nearest apartments were at least a half mile away, and a runner should have worked up a sweat by now. She smiled at him. He smiled back. Suddenly the dog broke free of its leash. It darted toward him and took a bite from the inside of his shin before the jogger was able to pull it away.
"I'm so sorry," she said as she thrust the yipping dog under her arm.
"It's all right," he said,
wincing as he dropped down on his right knee and examined the painful wound. He set his computer aside, took out his handkerchief, and wiped away the blood from the two semicircular rows of teeth marks. The woman knelt beside him, her face a mask of concern. With her right arm clasped tightly around the frenzied terrier, she held out her left arm, offering him the water bottle.
"This will help," she said.
"Thank you, no,"
Fields Hutton said, as the teeth marks filled anew with blood. Something wasn't right about this. She was too concerned, too attentive. Russians weren't like that. He had to get out of here. Before Fields Hutton could stop her, the woman poured water on his wound. Rivulets of blood streamed down his leg into his sock, as Fields Hutton reached out to stop her.
"What are you doing?" he demanded as she emptied the bottle on his wound. "Miss, please."
He rose, then she did, backing away as she stood. Her expression was no longer concerned, but devoid of emotion. Even the dog was silent. Fields Hutton's suspicions turned horribly real as the stinging in his leg began to fade, along with sensation in his feet.
"Who are you?"
he demanded as numbness spread up his leg and he began to feel dizzy.
"What did you do to me?"
The woman didn't answer. She didn't have to. Fields Hutton suspected he'd been poisoned with a fast-acting chemical agent. As the world began to spin, he thought about Leon and bent to retrieve his computer. He fell, grabbed the handle, and dragged the laptop along as he crawled toward the river. When his legs became completely numb, he tried to claw ahead, to remain conscious. He wanted to stay alive long enough to throw the computer into the Neva. But then his shoulders began to lose all sensation. His upper arms became dead weight, and he fell forward. The last thing Keith Fields Hutton saw was the Golden River flowing just a few meters away. The last thing he heard was the woman behind him say, "Goodbye." And the last thing he thought was how Peggy would cry when Commander Hubbard informed her that her lover had been killed on a mission in St. Petersburg. His head rolled slowly to the side as the VX nerve agent stopped Fields Hutton's heart. Chapter 9. Sunday, 9 p.m., Belgorod, the Russia-Ukraine border. The Kamov Ka-26 radial-engined helicopter landed on the flood-lit patch of earth, its twin rotors kicking up dirt and swirling it into inverted seahorse patterns. While soldiers ran over and began unloading crates of communications equipment from the bay after the pilot's cabin, Interior Minister Dugin stepped out. Holding his fedora with one hand and the front of his greatcoat with another, he ducked low and walked briskly from the landing area. Dugin had always loved temporary bases like this one. Empty fields transformed overnight into pulsing centers of power, boot prints on the wind-swept soil, the dusty air ripe with the smell of diesel fuel. The base was set up for mountain warfare, using a configuration designed in the closing days of the war in Afghanistan. To his right, 100 yards away, was row after row of large tents, each housing a dozen soldiers.
There were 20 tents in a row, and they reached far beyond the glare of the floodlights, nearly to the distant foothills. Beyond them, at the north and south corners of the camp, were firing pits for riflemen, and dugouts with overhead covers. In the event of a war, these positions would be used to protect the base from guerrilla attacks. To the left, where there were no hills, were rows of tanks, armored vehicles, and helicopters, the mess area and canvas shower stalls, garbage pit, medical tents, and supply depots. Even at night, there was life here, mechanized, electric, and invigorating. Off in the distance, straight ahead, Dolgin saw the immaculate vintage PS-89 twin-engine monoplane that belonged to Dmitry Shovich. Two men stood guard, each carrying automat assault rifles. The pilot sat in his seat, ready to depart at a moment's notice. Looking at the plane, the interior minister felt a chill. What had only been talk until now was about to become a reality. The men and materiel here, and the equipment en route, would take them only so far. To get the money he needed to help undo the disastrous results of the election, he was about to make a pact with the devil. He only hoped that Kosygin was right, that the escape clause would work when the time came. Beyond the supply depot were three more tents, the weather station, with its sensors outside, on tripods hooked to computers inside, the communications center, with one satellite dish pointing northwest, another southeast, and the command tent. General Mikhail Kosygin was standing outside the last of these, his legs spread wide, hands locked behind his back, head held stiffly erect. An orderly stood behind him, to his right, also holding onto his hat. Though the hem of the general's jacket, his pant legs, and the flaps of the tent kicked wildly in the wash, Kosygin didn't seem to notice. From the iron-black eyes to the deeply cleft chin to the ruddy scar that ran diagonally between them, the 6-foot-4-inch general was the quintessence of his strong, confident Cossack stock.
"Welcome, Nikolai," the general said. "It's good to see you."
Kosygin wasn't speaking loudly, but his voice carried over the din of the helicopter.
Dolgin shook Kosygin's hand.
"It's good to see you too, Mikhail."
"Oh, then why do you look so grim?"
"I'm not grim," Dolgin said defensively. "I'm preoccupied."
"Ah, the great mind always working, like Trotsky in exile."
Dolgin shot him a look.
"I can't say I like the metaphor. I would never have opposed Stalin, and I hope that being hacked to death is not in my future."
Dugin's eyes held Kosygin's. The general was a man of charm and incredible poise. He was twice world champion and an Olympic competitor in pistol shooting, the result of a youth spent in the paramilitary DOSAF, the Voluntary Society for Cooperation with Army, Air Force, and Fleet, which trains young people in sports that have a military application. From there, his rise in the military was rapid and brilliant, though never quite fast enough to satisfy his towering ego.
Dolgin was sure that he could trust the general now. Kosygin needed the minister to help him leapfrog over his superiors in the coming order. But what about later?
Later was always a problem with people like Kosygin. Kosygin smiled.
"Don't worry, there are no assassins here. Only allies. Allies who are getting tired of maneuvers, who are eager to do something. But," the smile broadened, "allies who are as ready as ever to serve the minister."
"And his general," Dolgin said.
"But of course,"
Kosygin smiled as he turned and extended a hand toward his tent. Entering, Dolgin saw the third member of the strange triumvirate, Dmitry Shovich. The mobster was seated in one of three folding chairs set around a small green metal table. Shovich rose as Dolgin entered.
"My good friend," Shovich said softly.
Dolgin couldn't bring himself to call the fiend friend.
"Dmitry," he nodded, bowing slightly as he looked into the slight man's hazel eyes. They were cold, those eyes, and seemed more so because of the close-cropped peroxide white hair and eyebrows.
Shovich's long face was impassive, and his skin unnaturally smooth. Dolgin had read that Shovich had endured a therapeutic process of chemical peeling to remove the hard, cracked skin he'd suffered during 9 years in a Siberian prison. Shovich sat back down, his eyes never leaving the newcomer.
"You are not happy, minister."
"You see, Nikolai," General Kosygin said. "Everyone notices it."
He turned a chair around, straddled it, and pointed at Dugin, his index finger extended, thumb upraised as though his hand were a gun.
"If you'd been less serious than you are, perhaps we wouldn't be here now. The new Russia likes leaders who can laugh and drink with them, not someone who seems to carry the weight of the world on his shoulders."
Dugin unbuttoned his coat and sat in the last chair. There was a tray with cups, a teapot, and a bottle of vodka. He poured himself tea.
"The new Russia has followed a piper who will lead them laughing and drinking to destruction."
"It sounds like fun," Kosygin admitted. "But Russians have never known what's best for them. And fortunately, we are here to show them. What a noble bunch we are."
Shovich folded his hands on the table.
"General, I am not noble, nor am I interested in saving Russia. Russia sent me to hell for 9 years before Gorbachev's general amnesty freed me. I am only interested in the terms we discussed previously. Are they still acceptable to you both?"
"They are," said the general.
The gangster's cold eyes shifted to Dugin.
"Does he speak for you, minister?"
The interior minister stirred a lump of sugar into his tea. In the 5 years since his release, Shovich had gone from being a convicted robber to the leader of a global crime network that was comprised of an army of 100,000 men in Russia, Europe, and the United States, Japan, and elsewhere, most of whom had been admitted to the ancient order of the thieves' world after proving their loyalty by murdering a friend or relative. "Am I mad to be joining forces with this man?" Dugin asked himself. Shovich would be loyal only as long as they gave him 20% of the total assets of the former Soviet republics, which included the largest petroleum reserves on Earth, double the timber found in the Amazon, nearly a quarter of the planet's unmined diamonds and gold, and some of the world's largest deposits of uranium, plutonium, lead, iron, coal, copper, nickel, silver, and platinum. The man wasn't a patriot. He wanted to exploit the natural resources of a rebuilt Soviet Union and use their legitimacy to launder drug money. It made Dugin sick to contemplate, but Kosygin maintained that as long as he and his colleagues controlled the world's largest standing army, and Dugin ran the secret new surveillance operation in St. Petersburg, they would have nothing to fear from Shovich. He could be forced out at some later date, exiled to one of his residences in New York, London, Mexico City, Hong Kong, or Buenos Aires. Or he could be shot from the sky if he refused to go. Dugin wasn't so sure of that, but there didn't seem to be any other option. He needed a lot of money to buy politicians and military officials, to wage an aggressive war without Kremlin assent. Unlike Afghanistan, this would be a war the Russians could win. But money was the key. How Marx would have bristled.
"I speak for myself," Dugin said to Shovich. "Your terms are acceptable to me. On the day Zhanin's government is ousted, and I am named president, the man you select will become the new minister of the interior."
Shovich smiled a cold, chilling smile.
"What if I select myself?"
Dugin felt a flash of horror, though he was too seasoned a politician to show it.
"As I said, the choice is yours."
The tension of mutual distrust was thick when Kosygin broke it with a blustery,
"What about the Ukraine? What about Vesnik?"
Dugin looked away from Shovich.
"The president of Ukraine is with us." "Why?" asked Shovich. "The Ukrainians have the independence they sought for decades. Vesnik has more social and ethnic problems than he or his military will be able to manage," Dugin said. "He wants to tamp them down before they get out of hand. We will help him do that. He also longs for the glory days, as Kosygin and I do."
Dugin regarded the cold monster beside him.
"My allies in Poland are planning to stage an event there on Tuesday, 12:30 a.m. local time."
"What kind of event?" Shovich asked.
"My Spetsnaz assistant in St. Petersburg has already sent a secret team to the border town in Przemysław, Poland," Dugin said. "They'll arrange for an explosion at the Polish Communist Party office there. The communists won't tolerate the attack, and my people there will make sure the protest turns violent. Polish troops will be sent in, and the struggle will spread toward the Ukrainian border 6 miles away. At night, in the confusion, Vesnik's troops will fire on the Polish forces. When that happens, Kosygin jumped in, Vesnik will contact me to request military support. Zhanin will already have learned that he is outside the real circle of power. Now he will scramble to find out which generals are on his side, just like Yeltsin when his officers elected to pound Chechnya. He will have very few allies, and the politicians we're buying won't support him either. Poles of Ukrainian and Belarusian descent will also be persecuted. When the Ukrainians and I counterattack, White Russia will join us, bringing the front to within 100 miles of Warsaw. Russians will be caught up in nationalistic frenzy, while Zhanin's foreign bankers and businessmen desert him. He'll be finished.
A key to our success, said Dugin, is keeping the United States and Europe from becoming involved militarily. He looked at Shovich. We will work on that diplomatically, claiming that this was not imperialism, but an attack on the Federation. But if that doesn't work, the general has talked to you about threatening key officials.
I did, Kosygin said.
But Dmitri told me he has a better idea. Why don't you tell him, Dmitri?
Dugin regarded Shovich as the mobster adjusted himself in his chair. Dugin sensed that Shovich did it just to make him wait. He settled back, crossed his leg, brushed mud from the side of his black boot.
My people in America tell me that the FBI has gotten very good at counter-punching, Shovich said. If we run gambling or drug operations, they merely try to contain us. But if we hit their people, they strike back hard. It keeps the streets from becoming a war zone. Since most of the mobsters are in this for the money, not for politics, they refuse to attack government targets.
Then what do you propose? Dugin asked.
An object lesson against a civilian target, Shovich said.
To what end? Dugin asked.
Kosygin answered,
To get America's undivided attention. When we have it, we tell them that if they leave us alone in Eastern Europe, there will be no further acts of terrorism, and we'll even turn over the terrorists so that President Lawrence can look swift and decisive.
Of course, Shovich said, you will have to reimburse my colleagues in America for the loss of a man, but that will come out of your little treasure trove.
Of course,
Kosygin agreed. He reached for the bottle of vodka and regarded Dugin.
As we've said all along, Minister, all we need do is hold the U.S. off until the nightly news shows videos of soldiers who have been maimed or killed. The people of the United States will not tolerate American casualties. With the election just months away, President Lawrence will not intervene.
Dugin looked at Shovich.
What kind of civilian target will you strike?
I wouldn't know, he said with disinterest.
My people live there. Some of them are mercenaries, and some of them are patriots. But whoever is picked will know how to strike at the American soul. I have left it entirely in their hands.
He smiled humorlessly.
By this time tomorrow, we'll have seen it on the news. Tomorrow, Kosygin said. We are men of action.
He poured vodka in his and Shovich's cups.
Our friend Nikolai does not drink, so we'll allow him to toast us with tea.
He raised his cup.
To our alliance!
As the men touched the rims of their cups together, Dugin felt a burning in his belly. This was a coup, a second revolution. It was empire building, and people were going to die. But while he accepted that, he found it difficult to accept Shovich's casualness. The mobster had moved from the concept of kidnapping to killing as though there was no difference. Dugin sipped his tea and reminded himself that this unholy marriage was necessary. Every leader made compromises to move forward. Peter the Great changed Russian art and industry with ideas he brought from Europe. German cooperation enabled Lenin to overthrow the Tsar and withdraw from World War I. Stalin consolidated his power by murdering Trotsky as well as hundreds of thousands of others. Yeltsin forged alliances with the black marketeers to keep his economy from collapsing entirely. Now he was collaborating with a gangster. At least Shovich was a Russian.
Better that than going to the United States with hat in hand, begging for money and moral support, as Gorbachev and now Zhanyin had done. As the others emptied their cups, Dugin avoided Shovich's eyes. He tried not to think of the means, only the ends. Instead, he envisioned a map on the wall of his office, a map of a grand new Soviet Union. Chapter 10. Sunday, 8 p.m., New York City. After receiving the bagel order from St. Petersburg, Hermann Josef had put 10 pounds of plastique in a shopping bag. He placed bagels on top of them. Then he walked 3 blocks to Everything Russian, a shop that sold books, videotapes, and other goods from the homeland. 60 minutes later, he'd taken another 10 pounds of explosives to Mickey's pawn shop of Brighton Beach. During the day, Hermann had made 15 deliveries, bringing a total of 150 pounds of explosives to different locations. He didn't know if he was being followed, but he assumed that he was, so at each stop he took payment for the deliveries, even bitching audibly on the way back if his tip wasn't big enough. When Hermann left each site, the explosives were carried by another messenger to the Nicholas Senior Citizens Home, where they were packed into a body bag, taken to the Cherkasov Funeral Home in the St. Mark's section of New York City, and loaded into a coffin. The Chekhov family left the procuring of weapons and explosives to the Belniks. Their expertise was in planning and executing operations. The Queens Midtown Tunnel stretches under the East River in New York from 36th Street between 2nd and 3rd Avenues. It connects Manhattan Island to the Long Island Expressway in the borough of Queens. The 50-year-old tunnel is one of the principal arteries from the city, and at any given time its 6,000-foot length is filled with traffic. At this time, on a warm Sunday evening, the tunnel was not being used by commuters. The bright orange lights lit the way for families returning from a day in the city, or travelers heading to JFK International or LaGuardia Airport. Tall, white-haired, white-bearded Eval Ekdal rolled down the window of the hearse. He breathed in the oil-thick air, air which reminded him of Moscow. He didn't think about who the people around him were or what they were doing. It didn't matter. Their deaths were the price of fighting for a new world order. As he neared the tunnel exit, the Russian native pushed in the cigarette lighter. His left front tire blew, and he guided the swerving hearse to the wall. He ignored the curses of drivers who had to change lanes to avoid hitting him. Americans were always swearing, as though bad things had no right to happen, and moreover, were directed at each of them personally. Ekdal put on his emergency lights, got out of the hearse, and walked to the tunnel exit. Upon emerging, he took a cellular phone from his pocket and pretended to speak. He continued to speak as he walked toward the toll booths. He passed a transit officer who was sitting in a police car by the booths. The young man asked if he needed help.
"Thank you, no," said Ekdal in thickly accented English. "I've phoned for help."
"Is it just the tire?" asked the officer.
"No," Ekdal told him. "The axle."
"Well, it's dark in there," the officer said. "Someone's gonna hit you. You got flares?"
"No, sir."
He popped the trunk. "We'd better go put some out."
"Thank you," said Ekdal. "I'll join you in a moment. I must phone the bereaved."
"Yeah," the officer grinned. "Hell of a thing to have a funeral with no body."
"Exactly, sir," Ekdal said.
The officer got out of the car and went to the trunk. Removing a box of flares, he headed toward the tunnel, whistling. Still pretending to talk into the phone, Ekdal walked around the toll booth. Moments later, a cutlass came through one of the token gates and pulled up beside him. Before getting in, Ekdal pressed the pound sign on the numeric keypad. As the cutlass sped off, a yellow fireball erupted from the mouth of the tunnel, sending smoke, chunks of stone, and shards of metal in every direction. Cars just emerging from the tunnel were blown end over end. One cartwheeled over the transit officer and smashed into a van at the toll booth. Both vehicles blew apart, engulfing the toll booth in flame. Other cars were pounded flat at the entranceway by falling debris, while inside the tunnel there were the muffled sounds of secondary blasts as burning cars exploded. Within moments, the toll plaza was covered with rolling white smoke and a thick, horrific silence. After several seconds, the silence was broken by the bass fiddle groan of bending girders and the crack of concrete. A moment later, a quarter mile of expressway and the buildings along it shook as the roof of the tunnel collapsed. The roar of the water was like an ocean gone mad as it poured into the breach. The walls of the tunnel were battered down under the pressure, and shattered pieces were washed through the mouth of the tunnel as the river pushed the cars and fallen stone out of the way. The hiss of extinguished fires was drowned by the surging water as the river flowed outward, along the highway, taking down the few cars and street lamps that still stood. Steam poured from the broken mouth of the tunnel, rising skyward to mingle with the darker smoke. As the waters settled and the debris came to a rest, sirens sounded in the distance. Within minutes, the police helicopters were racing low along the expressway, videotaping traffic leaving the scene. But Ekdol wasn't worried. In less than a half hour, he'd have reached the safe house. The car would be dismantled in the garage, and he would have burned the false beard, mustache, sunglasses, and baseball cap he was wearing. For now, his job was finished. Arnold Belnick and his mercenary Bagel Brigade would be paid handsomely for their role in this, and then it would be up to other soldiers in the Grozny cell to continue what he had begun. Though his own life was about to be forfeited, he was honored to surrender it in the name of the new Soviet Union. Chapter 11, Sunday, 9:05 p.m., Washington, D.C. Mike Rogers loved Khartoum. It wasn't soft and warm like Elizabeth or Linda or Kate or Ruthie, but he didn't have to go out in the middle of the night to take it home. The movie was right there in his Laserdisc library, along with other favorites like El Cid, Lawrence of Arabia, The Man Who Would Be King, and virtually everything John Wayne ever made. What's more, he didn't have to be sociable. The movie didn't require him to do anything except put it in the player, sit back, and enjoy himself. Rogers had been looking forward to watching Khartoum all day, which is why he should have known that something would come between him and his film. He'd begun his Sunday by jogging his daily 5 miles, then he made coffee, black, no sugar, sat at the dining room table with his laptop and brought himself up to speed on Paul Hood's schedule, now his schedule, for the coming week. There were meetings with the heads of the other U.S. intelligence groups about sharing information more efficiently, a preliminary budget hearing, and lunch with the head of the French Gendarmerie Nationale, Benjamin. Just the thought of all that talk made his mouth dry. But there were some real challenges ahead as well. He'd be sitting down with Bob Herbert and Matt Stoll, their computer genius, to work out programs for coverage from the new ED satellite, the Electronic Disruptor. The ED satellite was being tested over Japan and could disrupt electronic impulses in objects as small as a desktop computer. He would also be receiving data from personnel on the ground in the Middle East, South America, and elsewhere. And then there were reports from U.S. agents in the Russian army. He was looking forward to news of the petroleum, oil, and lubricants distribution overhaul, and he was curious to see how the new Russian president planned to compensate for personnel cutbacks in both the troop rear and operational rear. Most of all, he was looking forward to the first conceptual sit-downs with op-center engineers for the proposed regional op-center. After Korea, it had occurred to him that they should have mobile facilities, which could be shuttled anywhere in the world. If it was feasible, one or more ROCs could make them an even more effective intelligence unit. After lunch, Rogers had gone to the shooting range at Andrews. There were days when he could dance around a bullseye with a .45 caliber M3 grease gun and miss it every time. Then there were days when he could pick his teeth with a .22 caliber Colt Woodsman. Today had been one of those good days. After 2 hours of marksmanship that left Air Force personnel stunned, Rogers visited his mother in the Van Gelder nursing home. She was no more lucid than she'd been since her stroke 2 years before. But he read to her, as he always did, her favorite Walt Whitman poems, then sat and held her hand. After he left, he met an old Vietnam buddy for dinner. Andrew Porter owned a chain of comedy clubs up and down the East Coast, and he made Rogers laugh like no one else. While they were drinking coffee and getting ready to pay the check, Rogers' pager beeped. It was Assistant National Security Director Toby Grumet. He used his cellular phone to call her back. Toby informed him of the New York bombing and of an emergency Oval Office meeting called by the president. Rogers apologized to Porter and left at once. As he raced along the highway, Rogers' thoughts went to General Charles Chinese Gordon. Gordon's efforts to protect indefensible Khartoum from the fanatical hordes of the Mahdi were at once among the boldest and most insane military adventures in history. Gordon paid for his heroism with his life, taking a spear in the chest, and having his head paraded around on a pike. But Rogers knew that that was how Gordon had wanted to die. The Englishman had traded his life for the chance to tell a tyrant, "No, you can't have this place without a fight." Rogers felt the same way. No one was going to do something like this to his country, not without a fight. He listened to the news on the radio and spoke on the phone as he drove to the White House. He was glad he had something to do. It kept him from dwelling on the horror. There were over 200 deaths. The East River was shut down to traffic, and the FDR Drive on Manhattan's east side would be closed for days while it was examined for structural damage. Other transit points were being checked for explosives, bridges, railroads, airports, highways, subways, meaning that the hub of the world's economy would be effectively shut down on Monday morning. Op Center's staff FBI liaison, Daryl McCaskey, phoned Rogers and told him that the FBI had taken charge of the investigation and that Director Aganis would be at the meeting. McCaskey told Rogers that the usual list of extremists had called to take credit for the bombing, but no one believed that the real perpetrator had come forward, and McCaskey had no opinion as to who the terrorist might be. Rogers also received a call from Assistant Deputy Director Karen Wong, who ran Op Center on weekend evenings. "General," she said, "I understand you've been called to a meeting."
"Yes, I have."
"Then here's some information you should take with you. As soon as Lynn Dominic in Cryptology heard about the explosion, she took a fresh look at that bagel order from overseas. The timing and receiver location made it seem like a good fit."
"What did she find?"
"Knowing the outcome has allowed her to work backward," Wong said, "albeit very quickly. And it seems like a match. Assuming the last bagel represents the tunnel, she created a map. The rest of the order seems to be points in Manhattan, for example, places to deliver components of the bomb."
Then we'd be up against the Russians, he thought with dread. And if they were behind this, it would not be regarded as terrorism. It would be considered an act of war.
"Tell Lynn that was heads-up work," Rogers said. "Memo her findings and secure fax it to the Oval Office."
"Right away." "There's something else, though, that's happened in St. Petersburg," she said. "We've just learned from Commander Harry Hubbard at DI-6 in London that he lost two people there. The first one was yesterday afternoon, a veteran named Keith Fields Hutton. He was outside the Hermitage, by the Neva, and suffered what the Russians say was a heart attack."
"A euphemism for we killed him," Rogers said. "Was he checking on the studio?"
"Yes," Wong said. "He never got to phone a single report, though. That's how fast he was spotted and terminated."
"Thanks," Rogers said. "Has Paul been briefed?"
"Yes," said Wong. "He called after he heard about the explosion. He asked to talk to you after the meeting."
"I'll phone him," Rogers said as he pulled up to the sentry at the gate, which led to the winding White House driveway. Chapter 12. Monday, 6 a.m., St. Petersburg.
When he was a boy growing up in the early 1950s in the small town of Narian Mar on the Arctic Ocean, Sergei Orlov thought he would never treasure a sight more than he did the orange glow of the hearth in his parents' home as he trudged through the snow carrying two or three fish tucked into his canvas sack caught in the small lake near his home. For Orlov, the glowing fireplace wasn't just a beacon in the cold, dark night. It was a bright and hopeful sign of life in a cold and barren wasteland. Circling the Earth in the late 1970s, flying five Soyuz missions that ranged from 8 to 18 days, and commanding the last three, General Sergei Orlov saw something even more memorable. It was not something new. Dozens of cosmonauts had seen the Earth from space, but whether they had described our world as a blue bubble, a beautiful marble, or a Christmas tree ornament, they all agreed that seeing it gave them a new outlook on life. Political ideologies were no match for the power of that fragile globe. Space travelers realized that if humans had a destiny, it was not to fight for control of their home, but to cherish its peace and warmth as they journeyed to the stars. "And then you return to Earth," Orlov thought, as he stepped from the number 44 bus on Nevsky Prospekt. "The resolve and inspiration weaken as you're asked to do things in the name of country, which you can't refuse." Russians don't refuse. Orlov's grandfather was a czarist, yet he fought the White Russians during the Revolution.
His father didn't refuse when he fought in the Second Ukrainian Front during the Second World War. It was for them and not for Brezhnev that he had trained a new generation of cosmonauts to spy on the United States and NATO forces from space, as well as to work on new chemical poisons in zero gravity. He was trained to see the world not as the home of all humans, but as a thing to be peeled and cut up and devoured in the name of a man called Lenin. Then there are the parts coveted by men like Minister Dugin, he thought, as he walked briskly along the boulevard. Though it was still early, workers were already arriving at the Hermitage to prepare it for the daily crush of tourists. Though the minister was affable enough and seemed consumed by an almost narcotic contentedness when discussing Russian history, particularly the Stalin years, his worldview was out of step with the times. And when Dugin made his monthly trips to St. Petersburg, it seemed that the minister's memories of the Soviet years became more and more idealized. Then there were men like Ruski, who didn't appear to have any worldview. They simply enjoyed power and control. Olaf had been alarmed by Assistant Security Director Glinka's surreptitious call to the apartment. Glinka knew how to play both sides of the fence, but Olaf believed him when he said that Ruski's activities over the past 24 hours had been unusually secretive. It started when Ruski insisted on handling himself the trivial investigation of an intrusion alert the day before. It was followed by unlogged and coded computer communications to an operative in the field, not telling anyone where he was going, and mysterious dealings with a local coroner. "I've been ordered to work with Ruski," Olaf told himself, "but I won't let him run rogue operations." Whether Ruski liked it or not, he would toe the line, or he would be restricted to a desk job. As long as Ruski had Interior Minister Dugin's support, threatening him would be difficult, but Olaf had overcome difficulties before. He bore the scars to prove it, and was willing to bear more if need be. He had learned English so that he could travel as a goodwill ambassador when, in fact, he was busy acquiring and sneaking home books, just so he could see what the rest of the world was thinking and reading. Olaf raised the collar of his off-white trench coat against the knifing wind and tucked his black-rimmed glasses into his pocket. They always fogged when he came back outside from the over- or underheated bus, and he didn't have time to fuss with them. As if it weren't frustrating enough to need them at all, these eyes that had once been keen enough to pick out the Great Wall of China from nearly 300 miles in space. Despite the problem with Ruski, Olaf's full-lipped mouth was relaxed, his high forehead unwrinkled beneath the brim of his gray fedora. His striking brown eyes, high cheekbones, and dark complexion were, like his adventurous spirit, a part of his Asiatic heritage, Manchu. His great-grandfather had once told him that his family was part of the first wave of warriors that had poured through China and Russia in the 17th century. Olaf didn't know how the old man could place them so precisely, but it suited him to think that he was descended from a pioneering people, benevolent despite having been conquerors. Standing just under 5'7", Olaf had the narrow shoulders and slender build that had made him an ideal, resilient cosmonaut. Though his record as a fighter pilot had been flawless, Olaf carried physical and mental mementos from his years in space. He walked with a permanent limp due to a left leg and hip badly broken when his parachute failed to deploy in what turned out to be his last mission. His right arm was severely scarred when he pulled a cosmonaut in training from the wreck of a MiG-27 Flogger-D. He had pegs inserted in his hip to enable him to walk, but declined to undergo plastic surgery on the arm. He liked the way his wife oohed and oohed whenever she saw her poor, singed bird. Olaf smiled as he thought of his precious Masha. Though today's breakfast had been cut short by Glinka's call, the afterglow of being with her still warmed him. More so because it would have to hold him until tomorrow, which was the earliest he'd be seeing her again. As always before he left on a mission, the two of them went through a ritual they'd begun nearly 20 years ago, before he rode his first flaming rocket into space. They held each other tightly and made sure they parted with no unspoken thoughts or anger, nothing they would regret if he failed to return. Masha had come to believe that the day they broke the tradition, he wouldn't come back. Those days with the Mir and Salyut space stations, he thought, smiling. Years of working with Kazim, Solovyov, Titov, Manarov, and the other cosmonauts who spent weeks and months in space. Enjoying the sterile beauty of Vostok and Voskhod spacecraft, of the Kvant astronomy module that allowed them to explore the universe. experiencing the sound and fury of the mighty Energia rockets sending payloads skyward. He missed it all. But 11 months before, the space program was broke and in near collapse, and the 49-year-old officer had agreed to command this place, a high-tech operations center that was being designed to spy on friends and foes abroad and at home. Ministry of Security Chief Cherkasov had told him that he had the calm and detail-oriented nature that was perfect for running a high-pressure intelligence facility like this, though Orlov couldn't help but feel he was being demoted. He'd gone from touching the vault of heaven to being cast underground into hell, and he'd been spoiled by the many humanitarian scientists he had worked with at the Yuri Gagarin Space Center outside Moscow. As the Manchu had understood, progress and power should be used to ennoble people, encourage them to make sacrifices, not control and herd them. But Masha agreed with Cherkasov. She told her husband it was better for someone with his temperament to run the operations center instead of someone like Ruski, and she was right about that. Neither the colonel nor his new best friend, Interior Minister Dugin, seemed to know where the interests of Russia ended and their personal ambitions began. As Orlov walked briskly along the broad boulevard, the bag lunch and bag dinner his wife had prepared tucked under his arm, he gazed across the river at the Frunze Naval College that housed the dozen soldiers of the center's special operations force, Mullet, Hammer. Masha had been right about Ruski as well. After he told her who his second-in-command was to be, the man who had been involved with their son Nikita in the incident in Moscow, Masha told him not to allow Dugin to force Ruski on him. She knew they would clash, while he thought that working on a common project in such close quarters would force them to trust and maybe respect one another. Now reckoning seemed inevitable. What made his wife so smart and him so naive? His eyes moved along the structures on the opposite side of the Neva as the slanting sunlight put yellow faces on the stately Academy of Sciences and Museum of Anthropology directly across from him, and threw long brown shadows behind them. He took a long moment to drink in their beauty before entering the museum and the complex below. Though he was no longer able to see the Earth from space, there was still much to savor down here. It bothered him that Ruski and the minister never stopped to look at the river, the buildings, and especially the art. To them, beauty was merely something to hide under. Upon entering the museum, Orlov walked toward the Jordan staircase and the entrance to the secret new arm of the Kremlin, a facility at once practical and idiosyncratic. The practical side was the Hermitage site itself. It had been chosen over potential locations in Moscow and Volgograd because operatives could be moved in and out inconspicuously with tour groups. Because agents could travel easily from here to Scandinavia and Europe, because the Neva would hide and disperse most of the radio waves coming from equipment at the center, because the working TV studio they'd built gave them access to satellite communications, and most important, because no one would attack the Hermitage. The idiosyncrasy came from Minister Dugin's devotion to history. The minister collected old maps, and in his collection were the blueprints of Stalin's wartime headquarters under the Kremlin. Rooms that were not only bomb-proof, but led to a private subway tunnel that would have been used to shuttle Stalin from Moscow in the event of an attack. The minister revered Stalin, and when he, now President Zhanyin, and the head of the Ministry of Security first planned this communications and spy facility for Boris Yeltsin, Dugin insisted on using the layout that worked for Stalin. The design actually worked out well, Orlov felt. As in a submarine, the tight, somewhat claustrophobic quarters helped to keep workers focused on the tasks at hand. Orlov acknowledged the guard as he passed. The general used the keypad to enter. Once inside, he showed the receptionist his ID, despite the fact that she was Masha's cousin and knew him well. Then he made his way through the reception area and down the stairs to the TV studio. At the far end, he punched the day's 4-digit code on a keypad, and the door popped open. When Orlov shut it behind him, the dark stairwell's single overhead bulb snapped on automatically. He walked down the stairs where another keypad gained him access to the center. Entering the dimly lit central corridor, he turned to the right and strode toward the office of Colonel Ruski. Chapter 13, Sunday, 9:40 p.m., Washington, D.C. Rogers was ushered quickly through the outer and inner gates and was met at the White House by Assistant National Secretary Director Grumet. The 50-year-old woman stood nearly 6 feet tall, had long straight blonde hair, and wore very little makeup. Rogers had a great deal of respect for the Vietnam veteran, who had lost her left arm in a helicopter crash during the war.
"You're waiting for me," said Rogers. "Am I late?"
"Not at all, sir,"
Grumet said, saluting the general.
"The rest of us happened to be old married people who were sitting home watching TV when the blast happened. We had a little head start. I swear, just when you think the world can't get any sicker."
"Oh, I read history," Rogers said. "I never think that."
As Rogers entered the doorway, he took off the jacket of his uniform and handed it to the armed marine standing outside. Otherwise, the brass buttons would have set off the metal detector hidden in the jam. The detector didn't ping. After running a portable detector over the jacket, the marine returned it to Rogers and saluted.
"What's been happening?" Rogers asked Grumet as they walked down the short corridor to the Oval Office.
"We've responded by the book," she said. "We closed down immigration and rounded up the usual suspects. The FBI put various bureaus and agencies on alert, dropped divers into the wreckage. Director Rockland complained that the CIA spends too much money on political sensitivity training and not enough on keeping track of sociopaths, mad scientists, and ideological foes."
"That's Larry," said Rogers, "more outspoken than Mr. Kidd. What the hell do these people want, Toby?"
"Until we know more, we're treating it as a standard terrorist attack. It's possible that this was simply a criminal act, and that there will be a ransom demand. It's also possible that the bombing was the work of a psychotic individual or domestic group."
"Like the bombing in Oklahoma City?"
"Exactly. A group acting out their own deep anger and alienation from society."
"But you don't think so?"
"No, Mike, we don't. We think this was the work of a foreign terrorist group."
"Terrorists?"
"Exactly. If so, they could simply want publicity for their cause. Generally, though, terrorist acts are used instrumentally. That is, they are part of a plan to achieve larger ends."
"The question is, what is the goal of these people?"
"We'll know soon enough," Toby said. 5 minutes ago, the FBI got a call in New York saying that the president will be contacted by the terrorist. The caller provided the FBI with information about the size of the blast, its location, the kind of explosives used. It checked out exactly."
"Is he going to take the call?" Rogers asked.
"Technically, no," Toby said, "but he'll be in the room. We think that will satisfy..."
"Shoot," she said as her pager buzzed.
"They want us in there right now."
The two ran down the corridor. They were waved ahead by an assistant in the antechamber of the Oval Office and were buzzed through the inner door. President Mike Lawrence was standing behind his desk. He was drawn to his full 6'4" height, his hands on his hips, his shirt sleeves neatly rolled back a turn. Facing him was Secretary of State Av Lincoln. Lincoln was a former major league pitcher with a round face and thinning widow's peak. Four other officials were also present: FBI Director Griffin Aganis, CIA Director Larry Rockland, Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff Melvin Parker, and National Security Chief Steve Burkow. All of the men looked grim as they listened to a voice coming from the president's speakerphone.
"Save you the trouble of tracing this call," the thinly accented Russian voice was saying. "My name is Aval Ekdol. I am at 1016 Forest Road in Valley Stream on Long Island. It is a Grozny safe house, and you can have it and me. I will also stand trial and denounce the officials who brought me down. It will be a good show."
Grozny, thought Rogers as he took a seat beside the dashing young National Security Chief. Oh, Christ. Ascetic FBI Director Aganis wrote on a yellow pad, "Let me get people over there," and held it up. The president nodded, and Aganis left the room.
"Once you have me," Ekdol concluded, "there will be no further acts of terrorism."
"Why blow up the tunnel and then surrender yourself?" Burkow asked. "What do you want in return?"
"Nothing. What I mean is, we want the United States to do nothing."
"Where, when, and why?" Burkow asked.
"In Eastern Europe," said Ekdol. "A situation will develop militarily, and we want neither the U.S. nor its allies to become involved."
Chairman Parker picked up a phone near him. He turned his body so his voice couldn't be heard. Burkow said,
"We can't promise that.
The United States has interests in Poland, Hungary.
You have interests in the United States as well, Mr. Burkow.
Burkow appeared to be taken by surprise. Rogers just sat still, listening carefully.
Are you threatening other American interests? Burkow asked.
Yes, I am, said Ekdol. In fact, at the 10:15, a major suspension bridge in another American city will be blown up. Unless, of course, we've reached an agreement by that time.
All in the room looked at their watches.
As you no doubt realize, said Ekdol, you have just under 4 minutes.
The president said,
Mr. Ekdol, this is President Lawrence. We need more time.
Take all the time you want, Mr. President, said Ekdol. But you'll pay for it with lives. You can't reach me in time, even if you dispatched personnel when I gave you the address. And though you'll have me, you won't stop Grozny.
The president slashed his hand from side to side, and Burkow muted the phone.
Hit me, Lawrence said. Fast.
We don't deal with terrorists, Burkow said. Period.
Sure we do, said Lincoln. Just not in public. We have no choice but to deal with this man.
What about the next Tojo wannabe with a bomb? Burkow asked. What if Saddam does it next, or some neo-Nazi right here in the States?
We don't let it happen again, said CIA Director Rocklin. We learn from this. We prepare. Right now, we don't want another New York. Defuse the bomb. Nail the peckers later.
But it could be a bluff, said Burkow. He may be a nutcase who blew his wad under the East River.
Mr. President, said Rogers, let the bastard have this one. I know a little something about these Grozny fanatics. They don't bluff, and you see how hard they strike. Give them the win and we'll catch them with an end run.
You have an idea?
I do, he said.
At least that's something, the president said.
Right now, a spitball and a slingshot would be something, Burkow said. But is it the right something?
Lawrence rubbed his face with his open hands while Burkow scowled at Rogers. The national security chief was not big on capitulation, and he obviously had thought he'd an ally in Rogers. Ordinarily, he would have. But this was much bigger than what was happening here, and they needed time and clearer heads to deal with it.
Sorry, Steve, said the president. I agree with you in principle. God, how I do. But I've got to give this monster what he wants. Put him back on the line.
With a jab of his finger, Burkow unmuted the telephone.
Are you there?
The president asked.
I am.
If we accept your terms, there will be no blast?
Only if you do so at once, said Ekdol. You have less than a minute.
Then we agree, said the president. Damn you, we agree.
Very well, said Ekdol.
The phone was silent for a moment.
Where are the explosives? Burkow asked.
They are in the back of just another truck crossing just another bridge, said Ekdol. I just phoned the driver not to deliver them. Now, as I promised, you can come and get me. I'll say nothing of our agreement. But go back on your word, Mr. President, and you will be unable to stop my people in other cities and towns. Do you understand?
I understand, said the president.
And then the line went dead.
Chapter 14, Monday, 6:45 a.m., St. Petersburg.
Olaf touched the button on the speaker outside Ruski's door.
Yes, said the colonel in a strident voice.
Colonel, it's General Orlov.
The door buzzed and Orlov entered. Ruski sat behind a small desk to the left. There were a computer, telephone, coffee mug, fax machine, and flag on its gunmetal surface. To the right was the uncluttered desk of his assistant and secretary, Corporal Valentina Bielyev. Both of them stood and saluted when the general entered, Bielyev smartly, Ruski more slowly. Orlov returned the salute and asked Valentina to excuse them. When the door clicked shut, Olaf regarded the colonel.
"Has anything happened in the last day that I should know about?" Olaf asked.
Ruski sat slowly.
"A great deal has happened. As to whether you should know, General, our nation's satellites, field agents,
Cryptography and radio surveillance all become our responsibility later today. You have a lot to attend to.
I'm a general, Orlov said. My subordinates do all the work. What I'm asking, Colonel, is whether you've been doing more work than you should.
Specifically what, sir?
What business had you with the coroner? Orlov asked.
We had a body to dispose of, Roski said. A British agent. Brave fellow. We'd been watching him for days. He took his life when our operative closed in.
When was this? Orlov asked.
Yesterday.
Why didn't you log it?
I did, Roski said. With Minister Dugin.
Olaf's features darkened.
All reports are supposed to go to the computer file with a copy to my office. That's true, sir, Roski said. In an operational facility. But we are not that yet. We won't be securing the link from your office to the minister's desk for another 4 hours. Mine has been checked and secured, and I used it.
And the link from your office to mine, Olaf demanded, is that secure?
You did not receive a report?
You know I didn't.
An oversight, Roski smiled. I'll discipline Corporal Bielyev. You'll have a full report, if I may call Bielyev back, in just a few minutes.
Olaf regarded the colonel for a long moment.
You joined the Society for Cooperation with Army, Air Force, and Fleet when you were just 14, didn't you? Olaf asked. That's right, Roski said. You were an expert sniper at 16, and while other young men chose to leap Devil's Ditch from a running jump with a tracksuit and running shoes, you elected to leap the spikes at the widest point, with heavy boots and a rucksack on your back. Colonel General Odinstsev personally trained you and a select group in the art of terrorism and assassination. As I recall, you once executed a spy in Afghanistan with a spade thrown from 50 meters away. It was 52. Ruski's eyes shifted toward his superior. A record for a kill in the Spetsnaz.
Olaf came around the desk and sat on the edge.
You spent 3 years in Afghanistan until a member of your group was wounded on a mission to capture an Afghan leader. Your platoon commander decided to take the wounded man with you rather than administer the blessed death. As assistant commander, you reminded your superior that it was his duty to order the lethal injection, and when he refused, you killed the commander, a hand over his mouth, a knife thrust to the throat. Then you took the wounded man's life. Had I done otherwise, Roski said, High Command would have ordered the entire group executed as traitors.
Of course, Orlov said.
But there was an inquiry afterward, a question as to whether the soldier's wound was sufficient to require death. It was a leg wound, Roski said, and he was slowing us down. The regulations are quite specific on that count. The inquiry was merely a formality. Nonetheless, Orlov continued, some of your men were not happy with what you'd done. Ambition, a desire for promotion, those were some of the charges they made, I believe. There was concern for your safety, so you were recalled, and became part of the special faculty at the Military Diplomatic Academy. You taught my son and got to know Minister Dugin when he was still the mayor of Moscow. Is that all correct? Yes, sir.
Olaf moved even closer, his voice barely above a whisper.
You served your country and the military vigorously for just over 20 years. Risked your life and reputation. With all of this experience, Colonel, tell me, didn't you learn not to sit down in the presence of a superior officer unless given leave to do so?
Ruski's face flushed. He rose at once, slowly, his posture rigid.
Yes, sir.
Olaf remained seated on the desk.
My career has been different than yours, Colonel. My father saw firsthand what the Luftwaffe did to the Red Army during the war. He passed his respect for air power to me. I spent 8 years in the Air Defense Forces, flying reconnaissance for 4 years, then helping to train other pilots in ambushes, drawing enemy aircraft into killing grounds of anti-aircraft fire.
Olaf stood and looked into Roski's angry eyes.
Did you know all of this, Colonel? Did you study my dossier?
I did, sir.
Then you know I've never had to formally discipline any of my subordinates.
Most men are decent, even the conscripts. They only want to do their jobs and be rewarded for the work they do. Some make honest mistakes, and there's no reason to spoil their records because of that. I will always give a soldier, a patriot, the benefit of the doubt. Including you, Colonel.
Olaf came closer until their faces were inches apart.
But if you try and go around me again, he said, I'll catch you and have you returned to the academy with a notation of insubordination on your record. Are we clear on that, Colonel?
We are, sir,
Roski said, nearly spitting out the word.
Good.
The men exchanged salutes as the general turned and headed toward the door.
Sir,
Roski said. Olaf looked back. The colonel was still standing at attention.
Yes, Olaf asked.
What your son did in Moscow, was that an honest mistake?
It was stupid and irresponsible, Olaf said. You and the minister were more than fair with him.
It was out of respect for your accomplishments that we were, sir,
Roski said.
And he has a great career ahead of him. Did you ever read the file on the incident?
Olaf's eyes narrowed.
I've never had any interest in it, no.
I have a copy, Roski said.
It was removed from the records in General Staff Headquarters. There was a recommendation attached to it. Did you know that?
Olaf said nothing.
Nikita's company senior sergeant recommended expulsion for guliganstva. Not for defacing the Greek Orthodox Church on Ulitsa Arkhipova, or beating up the priest, but for breaking into the academy supply depot to get the paint, and for striking the guard when he tried to stop him.
Roski smiled.
I think your boy was frustrated after my lecture about how the Greek armed forces sold weapons to Afghanistan.
What's your point? Olaf asked. That you were able to teach Nikita to attack helpless citizens?
Civilians are the soft underbelly of the same machine that runs the military, sir,
Roski said.
A perfectly valid